Birth, Volume 3, The Gathering, Chapter 26. The Nephilim had fought their own war in a distant place with different rules and rulers. They were defeated, because they faced equals and the superior angelic beings of the Creator. Nonetheless, they fought because it was their nature and because their master, Lucifer, commanded them to fight. The Lightbringer, as he was called then, was one of the mightiest and most intelligent beings ever created in the very early moments of the expansion of the universe. When the concept of higher Adam was considered by the Council of the Creator, it was to be a direct path of inheritance of the Creator's power and authority. It tempted the Great Ones on the Council, and most of them submitted their will to the Creator, for him to choose the true Lord of this world. It was to be a focal point for the whole universe, and all the intelligent beings in it. When the time came for the organization of matter, the Lord was chosen. It was not Lucifer. At first, he used his semantical powers and vast knowledge of obedience to change the Creator's mind. But he closed his throne to the consideration. Lucifer then moved to his powers of coercion and counsel to convince the souls before the guff that they could be lost forever in the third dimension, never to return to this realm of glory with their apparent inheritance. There was no guarantee. They might fail or forget where they came from. These tiny and frail intelligences wanted more than anything to return home after their coming of age in the mortal worlds, but most imagined something was missing from Lucifer's assertion. But Lucifer's brightness and intelligence was unsurpassed by nearly every being in the universe. His words and promises garnered support from billions of those infant intelligences. True, they were not skilled or mighty like the Nephilim, but they had the greater potential, a potential that he always had imagined would be his subjects in his kingdom. And since these intelligences had the potential and authority to rule, they might someday, in the distant future, return to this realm as his unstoppable army to seize control of the universe for himself. It was his idea. It was his right, and he would not be undone. So these billions of tiny intelligences in their infant forms, along with the vast and highly skilled, battle-hardened forces of the Nephilim, they went to war. Most of the Nephilim were destroyed, but the most powerful of them were ejected from that realm and sent in third-dimensional form to an earth of rock and metal around a main-sequence sun in the Milky Way galaxy. Lucifer was stripped of his rank and cast to the same world in an unknown physical form. The eternal intelligences who followed Lucifer were ejected from the guff and also cast to that world where they might be born into a lower form of man and woman or into animals to live mortal lives without an inheritance like those that remained. The Nephilim taught the lower form of man about nirvana and the temporary nature of an inanimate earth. They gave them religions, but the long and sordid history of these races was recorded in pictures and songs. True access to the future was withheld from them. They built a world full of stone or metal gods and demons with rewards based upon power and worship of the forces of nature. They were taught the ways of war and dominion, enslaving or annihilating their enemies, and the glory of victory. For millennia they fought, betrayed, and carved each other into the dust of the ground. The Nephilim were out in the open in those days. Their twisted forms were depicted in paintings and statues like they were gods. They were nearly immortal. Their voracious lust for the flesh of this world was insatiable, and yet unable to keep up with its birth rate. They forced the intelligent life on Earth to do their bidding or die. The Nephilim that had survived the war were few in number, at around 200, but it did not take long to find the individual intelligences born on Earth who were attracted to their wisdom and learned the secret combinations well. They made complex calculations and predictions based on probability and common cause. They advanced generation after generation until their weapons could end the world itself. Their final wars split the ocean floor and sunk entire continents. Hundreds of cities were destroyed by fire brighter than a thousand suns, and their bones lay beneath ash and dust all over the lower earth. But the creation of the Eden world was finally completed by the small team under the direction of the Creator, far from the scarcity of the third dimension. Period by period, each phase of the world was formed and allowed to come to an ecological balance without noxious weeds or the things that torment the third dimension. And when higher Adam was placed on that world and then provided with a physiological compatible mate, the team rested for a period. It was during this period of rest that Lucifer saw his opportunity to take the souls that would be born on that world, for his knowledge was complete, and he had already seen this done on other worlds. He knew the process of merging a spirit with a physical body and the vulnerabilities that soul would have in that form. He knew the plan well. And he calculated that if he could place his seed into the formula, he could rob the whole of it from the Creator and have his rightful inheritance. When he located the world, even he was impressed with its perfection. Liquid water and a seemingly endless variety of plant life, all based upon the same DNA design as higher Adam, had been placed on it. It was perfectly geo-engineered with a dense atmospheric river of water. It was perfectly aligned with its equator in parallel with a nearby young star, so there was scarcely any movement in the river. The ground was watered nightly through a very high dew point. This Eden world was shielded from the stars. In his physical form, he went searching for Adam, and upon finding him, recognized him immediately. This was not one of the young souls waiting to be born through the great tree of souls. This being was hand-built by the Creator and instilled with the soul of one of the great ones that had actually helped with the creation of this world. He was the Ancient of Days. "Hello, my old friend," said Lucifer to the lone man on the world of Eden. "How do you know me?" said Adam. "Oh, pay no attention to that. I can see that your memory has been laid to rest while you are here." "I have come to help you along on your journey," said Lucifer. "What journey would that be?" "I have been here for many millennia and have named all life on this world. I am its manager, if that is a good word for it," said Adam. "Yes. Well, it is time for you to become what you were created to be. You must partake of the knowledge of good and evil so that you will be like God," said Lucifer. "I am looking for further light and knowledge, but I was forbidden from partaking of that fruit specifically. I will pass, friend. Goodbye," said Adam. "So be it. We will speak again, my friend," said Lucifer as he moved with his form in search of another being. Even without his memory, that formidable being was inside, and he would not be tempted. Somewhere on this world is an infant intelligence, born through the Tree of Souls. "It will be female, if my memory serves me," he said to himself. It is unknown how long it took Lucifer to find her. The Creator's engineering team had been gone for a long time, letting Adam alone for most of that time. He could see the scar on Adam's side, so he knew the gene matching and mitochondrial DNA had been sampled and used as a pattern from which to develop a compatible breeder for this higher Adam. He could not move like an angel in this form, so he traveled and used his intuition to finally locate the female. He watched her for a few days from a distance. It was not his nature to just barge in and offend. He studied her. She was graceful and bristled with life force like a cloud of tiny seeds thrown into the wind by a mighty tree. He had never seen an actual female human in physical form, naked. Her skin was like velvet, and yet she was strong and lean as she leaped across the grass and swam through the clear ponds of water. Every life form bathed in her presence. She caressed them with her hands and sent them on their way. Even the way she picked berries from the plants or plucked fruit from the trees was graceful and reverent. She was not like the females of Earth with their heavy brow and blemished skin. Oh, they were physically powerful, but they did not understand the flow of energy or the value of consideration of life like this female. He recognized perfection when he saw it, and realized for the first time the scope of what the Creator hoped to accomplish. He was breeding successors. The fury rose in him as he recalled his army's defeat over an inheritance that belonged to him. "I could not help but notice your beauty and your grace from here, Eve," said Lucifer with a controlled and warm tone to his voice. "Who are you?" she asked, turning her head to look at him. He didn't think he would ever feel that burning in his groin again. It rose like fire in him, almost surprising him. "I am a friend, my dear. I mean you no harm. You are truly the most stunning creature I have ever seen. How is it that you are here?" said Lucifer. "I am caring for this garden," she said without elaboration. "I was curious. If you knew what your purpose here was, would you like to know?" he asked. "Here? What does that mean?" she asked with her wide blue eyes. "Everything has a purpose. You, my queen, have a grand purpose upon which hang the very stars in heaven," he said, moving closer. He could smell her fertility, which further aroused his physical form. "You speak of things I've never heard before. Stars, heaven, what are these things?" she asked, moving toward him like a panther without moving her gaze from his. "How is it that Adam has not taught you these things? Why don't we sit and talk for a while?" he asked, smoothing his voice even more and motioning to a smooth, flat boulder by the pond. Whether it took a day or a month is not known, but it did not take long for Lucifer to beguile the female and arouse the physical urges in her to reproduce. As soon as his seed entered her body, the biochemical changes began. His sperm reached the perfect ovum and penetrated its outer layer with the assistance of the hyaluronidase enzymes present on the surface of his sperm. Instantly, it bound with the zona pellucida of that egg, and the acrosome reaction began to race through her immortal body, laying the groundwork for the aging of the coming human race that now belonged to him. With a dump of new hormones in her body, she turned to Lucifer as he came up out of the cool pond and shook his head. "I know you now. You're Lucifer," she said, pointing at him. "Well, yes, my dearest Eve. You see, your eyes are already opening," said Lucifer as he walked for the edge of the woods. "What do I do now?" she shouted at him with tears coming down her face. "I suggest you go and find Adam and get him to partake before it is too late for your human race," said Lucifer, laughing as he leaped into the shadows of the trees. She ran as fast as she could, but there was no path. The stones hurt her feet and the blades of the bushes lacerated her beautiful skin. She ran until the cool garden air burned in her lungs. Her dark hair stuck to her skin, and just when she thought she was lost, she heard his voice. Eve, came his strong and deep voice. O Adam, I am undone, she sobbed. What is this you are doing? You have injured yourself. Come here and let me treat you, said Adam with the thoughts of a boy. You don't understand. I am undone. I partook of the fruit, she said, weeping. Why? I remember commanding you not to partake of that fruit. Because I was commanded, said Adam, not knowing what to do or how to feel. Her heart was breaking now on the good soul of this perfect man. She had betrayed not only him, but every living thing on earth. When they come back, I will be cast out, and you will be left alone here. It is my fault. It's all my fault, she wailed. But why? He asked, unable to feel the pain she felt. That serpent, Lucifer, he beguiled me, and now I am with child this minute, she said. Eve, if you go, I will go with you. I will partake as well. Show me how, he said, holding her hands in his. She could feel the greatness in him, and that they were made from one another. She was his. It would always be so. She moved closer to him and pressed her erect nipples against his chest. She kissed him and breathed on him and reached for him. Their bodies did what they were designed to do. They had watched thousands of animals of all kinds mate before. Within minutes, the seed of life coursed its way through her cervix to find another ovum, and the process began again. The twins were growing from that point forward. Adam and Eve felt completely bonded and compelled to be next to one another forever. They washed, and Adam dressed her scratches and combed out her hair. He could smell her, and he would never forget it. We should cover ourselves. They could return at any time, my queen. The electric cart rolled quietly across the smooth concrete tarmac of the Denver airport facility. General Westmoreland silently wished he could be aboard the ancient spacecraft that had lifted off earlier en route for the moon. These craft were capable of local spaceflight, as the technology for interstellar flight was still only theoretical. These massive ships had been developed under the direction of the Nephilim and in the days of the Vedas. When a blinding competition for military technology continued without reserve for centuries, unabated. The human rulers of those days had been taught there was no limit to the number of times a soul could be born on this world, but it took the form of transmigration of the entity inside the body. Their religion was twisted and warlike. There was no need to promise anything like eternal salvation. The seeds of Lucifer and Adam would not arrive for many millennia yet to come. Boeing Aerospace Operations in Oklahoma City, Oklahoma, had developed the E-4B low-frequency transmit system for the 747-200 Looking Glass aircraft. After 2019, it was completely operational with a long-range transmission system in the ELF and VLF bands that could be bounced off of the ionosphere and diffracted over obstacles. It could even communicate into the water to submarines if they weren't too deep. The new technology was able to bounce around the plasma bolts that leapt between worlds at the poles. The cart came to rest at the base of the air stairs leading up to the all-white aircraft that was designed to disappear at high altitude. He briskly saluted the soldier driving the cart and the one at the base of the stairs as he quickly made his way up to the doorway. He turned around and looked at the airport, once bustling with aircraft and commercial business, now completely committed to his military efforts. It felt good to be in complete command. He turned on his heel and toe in a perfect about-face and walked into the body of the jumbo jet. To his left was the executive cabin, complete with sleeping quarters and full bathroom. To his right was the ante-cabin, filled with three long service centers, lined with flat screens capable of displaying and tracking thousands of air and ground assets and targets. 32 men in dark green flight suits stood up from their swivel chairs and saluted. He snapped a salute back to them and nodded for them to complete their pre-flight checks. "Who was the duty officer?" Wes asked in a firm voice. "Sir, I am Colonel Bradford, officer in charge of this shift." "Is the other shift on board?" he asked. "Yes, sir. All personnel accounted for," said the colonel. "Let's get the wheels up, Colonel," said West as he put his hands behind his back and walked into the private cabin to find a seat. "The 747-200 is capable of lifting 820,000 pounds, including fuel, to an altitude of nearly 60,000 feet at an airspeed of nearly 600 miles an hour, and by navigating the proper winds can cover the ground at an astounding 750 miles an hour. In the looking glass configuration, the lower deck area is fitted with additional fuel tanks, normally capable of handling 30 LD1 containers with 6,500 pounds in each one. The lower deck is configured to hold an additional 100,000 pounds of fuel, extending the range to nearly 20,000 miles. In this lightened configuration, carrying half of its design payload, the looking glass does not need much runway at all to take off, making it an extremely tactical in its ability to refuel and take off from small airports. The first engine spooled up and the plane's lights blinked as it switched over to the generator on that engine. Within less than a minute, the other four engines were spinning and the ship taxied quickly to the runway. He snugged his belt and looked at the screen displaying the remote forward-looking camera. It took less than 30 seconds at full power to get airborne, and the aircraft banked hard for the east, making a steep climb to catch the jet stream before reaching the Kansas border. Wes unbuckled, grabbed a bottle of water from the rack, and opened the cabin door to the situation room busy with keyboards tapping. "What do we have, Colonel?" asked Wes. "We have the ship marker signals locked in. They are nearing the moon and should make their maneuver in about 4 hours. By our calculations, they should arrive over Western Europe within 16 hours, sometime pre-dawn Paris time," said the colonel. "Will we have two-way capabilities when they arrive?" asked Wes. "Doubtful, sir. HARP has been running for 2 days and has our ionosphere completely pushed out of shape to make the bounce," said the colonel. "Is that a problem?" asked Wes. "Sir, the ionosphere will begin to reach terminal absorbance and will begin to fluoresce. The photons coming off the auroras will interfere destructively with our message band," said the colonel. "And if we turn it off?" asked Wes. "A couple of things can happen. The signal can become so attenuated that we can't resolve it from the background noise," said the colonel. "You said a couple of things," prodded Wes. "Well, sir, the second one has never happened. It's theoretical, but the downside is pretty bad," said the colonel. "Colonel, you have never worked for me before, so I will let that slide, just this once. I cannot make decisions based upon data like pretty bad. Now try again," said Wes, looking at the colonel in the eyes like he was a second lieutenant. "They call it an ionospheric breakdown. The calculations were done back in 1997 by a scientist in East Tennessee. Supposedly, he was the best in the world at this radio tomography stuff. He predicted that HARP could form an ion path under the right conditions from the surface to the ionosphere. He said that if the ionosphere were to be charged up high enough and that path were to form a connection, that a bolt of electricity 3,000 to 4,000 feet in diameter could come down to the ground, ablating the ground 6 inches at a time, 10 to 15 times a second, for up to a minute. The resulting energy release would be 1,000 times that of Hiroshima, and would cause the entire ozone layer to be obliterated within minutes," said the colonel. "See? That didn't hurt. Thank you, Colonel, said Wes as he walked past him to look at each of the situation screens on both sides all the way to the end of the cabin and back up the other side. He collected his thoughts and returned to the cabin to close his eyes for a while. The maps, charts, and targeting data were in his head now. Whatever gift he had would oscillate between math and music and physics and process this data into a multifaceted solution from which he would make his judgment for the next 24 hours. It seemed like only a few minutes when the soft knock came to the door. He rose, slipped his feet into his boots, and zipped them up. Within seconds, he opened the door. Sir, the ships have cleared the limb of the moon and will fall into a wide orbit above the Arctic Circle within a couple of hours, said the colonel. What's their velocity relative to the escaping Earth? Asked Wes. We have that information. It is live at Station 22, if you'd like to observe, sir, said the colonel. When are meals ready, colonel? Asked Wes. We don't have a regular scheduled meal on Looking Glass, sir. There's a full-time galley on board with a queue space, said the colonel. Put my name on the board, said Wes. The colonel pulled his hands from behind his back and looked at his tablet. He flicked across a few pages and found the galley queue and typed in General Morlaye's name. Done, sir. 40 minutes, said the colonel. Good enough. When does the next shift come on? Asked Wes. They begin phasing in at 00:00, sir, said the colonel. Thank you, colonel. I'm going to Station 22, said Wes. Yes, sir, said the colonel, pulling himself easily into attention. Carry on, colonel, said Wes, saluting him smoothly. Station 22 has a 42-inch screen about chest high. The operator sat in an elevated bar stool with a back that looked like a little like a gamer's chair. Every airborne asset could be visualized in two dimensions, or the screen could switch to a three-dimensional view with glasses provided to the viewers. It was an animation constructed from the best radar signature possible at the time. Stealth craft were often presented by the gravitational wave they generated, by their movement through space-time. The three large ships were the only assets in the area, so the screen was zoomed in to show the Arctic Circle 70,000 miles below the ships and closing. What's your name, airman? Asked Wes of the operator. Lewis, sir, said the operator. You a gamer? Asked Wes. Game programmer, sir. I came in from the NSA, sir, said Lewis. So, is this your program? Asked Wes. Oh, no, sir. It was here already, but I have modified it to work better, said Lewis. I am a quantitative sort of person, Lewis. Define better, said Wes, gripping his hands behind his back with impatience. I added point of view. We can look at the zone of conflict from any angle, including the ground, with this trackball, and I upgraded the IR decoder to resolve invisible so we can tell friendlies without transponders. Cuts out the collateral damage, even in smoke or the dark, said Lewis. Humor me. What doesn't work, said Wes, shifting to manage by difference. To tell you the truth, sir, it's pretty much blind. I mean, radar is fine, and infrared is relative to the surrounding energy picture, but it means we trust the enemy to provide us accurate data, which they never do. This is a good game, but it could be so much more, said Lewis. Show me the light, Airman Lewis. What do you need from me? Asked Wes. Permission to hack. I mean, permission to access the root file and set it up to receive other inputs, said Lewis. We cannot land, Airman Lewis, and we have no more transducers to provide any more inputs. So enlighten me on how you will make this happen, asked Wes, trying to enable the boy. HARP is running, sir. Consider that a flashlight. Well, we don't look for the light. We look for the shadows. We have all the transducers we need. They just need to be readdressed in the program, said Lewis. I know something about shadows and the light. How much time do you need? Asked Wes.
Uninterrupted?
I would say 4 hours, said Lewis. You have three.
Colonel,
said Wes, raising his head from the close conversation he was having with Lewis, give Airman Lewis the DLLs he needs to write your program where it can see in the dark, said Wes.
Yes, sir, said the colonel.
The Looking Glass aircraft had been airborne for nearly 14 hours. The ancient space carriers were approaching their staging position for the attack on Western Europe. Looking Glass was flying 5-mile circles around the Black Sea. Any further north and they wouldn't see past the plasma field between the worlds. Any further south and they might actually be in harm's way. From this point, they could scan the horizon and evaluate the target zone. General Morlaix made an executive decision to forego descending to 25,000 feet for refueling until after the attack was over. They had 8 hours of fuel left.
It's time, Colonel, said Wes, suddenly realizing how much he sounded like a warden escorting a death row inmate to the chamber.
The colonel looked over at the fire control station officers, who were already looking at him.
The launch code color is yellow. Send the order, said the colonel.
The two officers inserted their keys, turned them simultaneously, and typed in their authority codes. They opened their sealed envelopes and turned their four-sided individual key card to the yellow edge and covered the 2D barcode, revealing the 9-digit code. They each entered their code and pressed the red button that illuminated.
Launch code sent.
We are live, Colonel, said the first officer.
Airman Lewis, tell me you are live, said the colonel loudly.
Yes, sir, I'm live. But I'm still working on the code.
It will be another 30 minutes, said Airman Lewis.
I need visual, Lewis. Now, not tomorrow, barked the colonel.
Sir, with respect, the general gave me 3 hours. I'm coming up on 3 hours. I will have the display enhanced by then, sir, said Lewis.
Lewis, I can get someone, said the colonel.
No, sir. With respect, sir, I doubt that very much.
I will have it done, said Lewis, raising his voice to drive away the annoyance.
I will have it done, sir, said the colonel, quietly correcting him.
I will have it done, sir, said Lewis in the same tone.
As you were, airman, said the colonel coldly.
General, we are live with tracking, but we do not have enhanced visuals at this time, sir, said the colonel.
You realize I have no intel coming in from the battlefront.
That planet has no orbiting satellites to speak of, no air traffic, no missiles staged,
and we are detecting no radio traffic of any kind?
Asked Wes, like he was a computer reading a text file.
Yes, General, I realize that, said the colonel.
Does that bother you at all? Asked Wes, turning his face close to the colonel's for a private answer.
Yes, General.
It does, said the colonel, waiting for a clue on how to respond.
You are still on my airplane.
Tell me why that bothers you, Colonel, said Wes with the disarming tone to his voice he had learned from Semyaza.
My information indicates that the President and his rebel forces are occupying territory that belongs to the United States.
I know General Bainbury and Admiral Donetti, and I know they would fight for their cause.
What troubles me is that I cannot detect their methods, manpower, or machines by which they intend to do so, sir, said the colonel at last.
Do you recommend aborting the attack? Asked Wes.
Sir, I cannot see any defensive forces at all, said the colonel.
Would you abort the attack? Said Wes, boring into him.
No, sir, I would not abort the attack, barked the colonel as he fought out of his corner.
Carry on, then, colonel, said Wes, withdrawing his tone and putting his hands behind his back in parade rest to watch the screen on Station 22.
Colonel, I have a decoded message from the attack force of 150 vessels that will be in formation within 10 minutes.
The first wave has been deployed, and they are lining up for their first bombing run, said the Looking Glass Battle Communication Station.
Roger that. "Airman Lewis, do you have any new information for me?" asked the colonel. 15 minutes, sir. I have about 1,000 bits to put in for the holographic sequencing," said Lewis as he typed as fast as his fingers would go. Beads of sweat were moving down his forehead, and he focused on the algorithm step functions that could resolve enough detail. "You have 10, Lewis. I need to be able to see the battlefield. My looking glass is blind, Lewis," barked the colonel. "That is not helping, colonel. With respect, sir, shut the hell up," said Lewis, backspacing the coding error he just typed in. "Comm station, can the flight leader give us a distance and ETA for their first salvo?" asked the colonel. "Checking now, sir." "It will take a couple of minutes for a response, sir," said the airman at the communication station. "Quartermaster, do you have a fuel report?" asked the colonel. "We have 4 hours until we need to descend for refueling. The C-147 is in the air from Incirlik, ETA 3.5 hours at altitude, sir," said the quartermaster. "Roger that. Major Barnes, wake up the next crew and get them fed," said the colonel. "Yes, colonel. Hand off in 2 hours, sir?" asked Barnes. "Be station ready in 90 minutes, Major," said the colonel. 90 minutes, yes, colonel," said Barnes. "Sir, the flight leader reports that they are in formation 30,000 miles from the away point at 400 miles altitude. They will accelerate to Mach 20 and strike the edge of their target cities. He says the projectiles are accurate to 10 meters, sir," announced the comm station. "Roger that, Lewis. Are we ready yet?" asked the colonel loudly. "Almost, sir," said Lewis. "Airman, send the go code," said the colonel. "Yes, sir." "Go code away, go code away," repeated the airman as he sent the sequence to the flight leader. "General, the codes include the coordinates for the second pass to catch the first responders. We have about 30 minutes to abort that code, if you wish," said the colonel, leaning close to the general's right ear. "There will be no abort code. They must know the price for betraying their own race," said Wes. "I have the code completed, sirs," said Lewis. "Excellent. On screen, Mr. Lewis," said the colonel. "What are we looking at?" asked Wes. "You'll need these, sir," said Lewis, holding up 2 packages of polarized glasses. "What are we talking about here? Is this more of your 3-dimensional virtual reality gaming crap, Mr. Lewis?" asked the colonel. "No, sir. This is a hologram. Real time. This model takes the harp reflection and scatters and turns it into an image without the enemy knowing they are being scanned. There is no such thing as stealth with this technology. Everything leaves a gravitational disturbance, no matter how small it is, as long as it is moving through space, sirs," said Lewis, putting his glasses on. "These are the ships here?" asked Colonel. "Yes, sir. These are the carriers. These are the few weather satellites left in place," said Lewis. "And what is this distortion here?" asked Wes. "That, sir? That's about 550 miles above the surface. It could be energetic gases or plasma," said Lewis. "What do the colors mean?" "Quickly now, Lewis. The lead ship is moving out," said the colonel. "The red is the slowest moving objects. The yellow indicates higher velocity. Actually, the resolution is better than I expected," said Lewis, moving the trackball cursor through the layers on the holographic screen. "Exactly what is the resolution of your algorithm, Lewis?" asked the colonel. "It should resolve something as small as a few inches across, sir," said Lewis, with his voice trailing off. "What is it, Lewis?" asked the colonel. "I'm not sure. I mean, there shouldn't be anything there. I have no radar confirmation. Those particles are not plasma, sir. They're not moving, sir," said Lewis, clicking the trackball and zooming in as far as he could to the target zone. The ships were in a double line now, reaching attack velocity, where they would come very close to the upper atmosphere and retro away at high G-forces. They would be releasing photon torpedoes, each capable of flattening an entire city block and incinerating stone and steel for a mile in every direction. "Lewis, I need more information," said the colonel.
"It looks like debris, sir, but it's homogeneous, sir," said Lewis.
"What? You mean it's not satellite debris?" asked Wes.
"No, sir. That would be random-sized with reflecting surfaces. This is like a cloud of something, all the same size and dull as a stone," said Lewis.
"Calm. Send the abort code. Send the abort code now," shouted the colonel.
"Roger. Abort code sent. Abort code away," said the airman.
"It's too late, colonel," said Wes calmly.
"Sir, if they make a turn now, it will crush everyone in those ships," said Lewis.
"Very clever, Mr. Riker," said Wes.
"General, there are 150 of my men on those ships," said the colonel.
"We have 450 more, colonel. You can stay and watch this if you like. Call me when we are refueled. We won't make the same mistake twice," said Wes. He marched slowly down the corridor to the front of the Boeing 747-200 aircraft.
"Oh, and Colonel, send a patrol back to the moon and destroy their radar jamming station. Carry on, Mr. Lewis."
The colonel stood behind Lewis as the first ship plunged into Kyle Kramer's gravel road in space and was instantly pulverized. The weapons detonated, which caused a chain reaction with the outer craft and the attack, destroying all of them in less than a minute. The holographic screen turned bright white with the energy of the blasts as the two men took off their polarized glasses.
"Calm. Secure looking glass. Let's go get some fuel."
"Roger that. Secure the deck. Secure the deck. Rig for refueling," announced the airman at the communication station.